Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Bigfoot Notes in the Field. I'm your host, William Jevning. Before we get started, I'm going to have Jeremiah. We have Jeremiah Chance and Don, his two assistant regional directors for the Northeast, on this evening. We're going to talk about how the Sasquatch is physically adapted to its environment. So before we get started with that, Jeremiah, why don't you, you had a recent fairly lengthy interview and a very fascinating one on an account that happened about 2 weeks ago. So you want to give us an update on all that?
Sure, guys. How are you guys doing tonight?
Good. How are you doing, Jeremiah?
You guys behaving yourselves or no?
We're doing good.
Good, good. It's not just, this thing's been ongoing for quite a while now, and even before I was with with JRG, I've been trying to link up with this guy for quite a while now to get an interview with him. His property has been an active hotspot for a long time. As a matter of fact, when Don comes up here, the spot we research, in one of the spots I had one of my sightings, it's as far as the crow flies, it's no more than 15 miles. I'm not going to, obviously we don't want to throw out the names of these locations, especially now that these guys are members, and are going to give us access to research these properties. But, from the interview yesterday, I spent 2 hours with these guys, and like you just mentioned, Will, the last sighting on the property was 2.5 weeks ago. They have seen several different creatures, he mentioned 6 or 7 different creatures, numerous colors, just some amazing, amazing stories. I'm not going to ruin it by getting into them tonight. We have other stuff to cover, but like you said, we'll save it for the premium podcast. And these are very, very credible sources. Both of these individuals are in law enforcement. One of them was one of your, spent a lot of time in the military, like yourself, Will. Just great, great guys. And, we all grew up here in the same area. I know the family, they know mine. They've had tons of activity on that property for quite some time now. I've got some great audio that they've given us access to, which is some of the best audio that I've ever heard. Some good photos that I haven't had a chance to scan to my computer yet, but like you said, we'll get all that in for the premium podcast. And these guys, the guy that owns the property, his buddy was there yesterday too, who has been doing research with him for quite some time now, and they work together within their federal, they're within their law enforcement job, and they've had sightings together on this property. They've had separate sightings. The children have had sightings. The wife, you name it. These things are there, and they're there, and it's fascinating. I'm not gonna get, like I said, we won't get into it. I don't want to ruin it because it's gonna blow everybody's mind. We've all heard a lot of these stories, in our day as researchers, as far as these properties being inhabited by these creatures, as well as myself and Don and Will, all of us. And this is right up there with one of the best I've heard. So,
awesome. Well, we'll be looking forward to hearing all that.
Definitely. Definitely.
Well, Don and Chance, do you guys have anything new from your areas?
No, just a little bit more activity around my house. But, other than that, not really. No other sightings I've located, but I have had them still coming around my house up until about 3 weeks ago.
And we had, for everybody listening, Don and I had recorded, but there were some issues with the audio, so we're going to record, and it's great because you've had some additional things going on and things that you've recorded that we'll include in that, so correct. Everyone be looking forward to that.
Yes.
Well, let's go ahead and delve into the subject we have tonight. It's something we sort of touched on when we did Blab, but I did a little bit of homework on this one. So a lot of people can't wrap their heads around, I mean, the idea of a Sasquatch to begin with, let alone their physical size and the different attributes that they display. So I kind of wanted us to talk about that this evening.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So let me go around here and get a general, I guess, thought on, you know, the Sasquatch's physical, how they're physically adapted to their environments. Jeremiah, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think they're a master, absolute master of their environment. I think when, my personal belief is, if you have grown up, a group of us, it could have been you and I, Don, could have been, actually, Chance, it was you and I. If you have spent time in the woods as a hunter.
Yeah, it was me and you yesterday.
Okay, Don, yeah. At some point or another, you have been watched by one of these things. Absolutely. They're a physical master of their environment. You are in their element, and for anyone to ever think they can outsmart them in their element is sorely mistaken. It's not going to happen. The way they're built, the physical power, the agility is built for the wilderness. And like I said, I hate to keep reiterating myself, but they're a master of their environment, just like any other apex predator.
Okay, Don, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, their abilities, I have to say, something I noticed this summer is how quick and how fast they can get out of an area and how silently, being the size that they are. But around here, most of my thoughts go towards the winter, their survival out here. I mean, how do they really survive out here? I mean, they must be equipped. I can tell they're equipped a little differently than some of the ones down south.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's a good point. And actually, when I start this, there's some interesting points. But let me get the opinions first. Chance, how about you? What are your thoughts? Is Chance still with us or?
Oh.
Okay. Well, now I wished I would have written down the actual information, where the source where I got this from. But if you go online and you look, you can look. I mean, there's a lot of scientific information about wildlife out there, and I looked at a number of different studies, not just studies, but you know, papers and scientific documents that are online. So the first question that came to mind was, and this is one that sort of, I think, boggles people's minds, to use a Rene de Hinden term, is why is the Sasquatch the size they are? What makes it advantageous for them to be as large as they are? You know, a lot of people say, well, you know, if something's out there that real, it can't be that big and survive in, especially in the northwest, the northern forest across the U.S. Well, and Don, this sort of hits on what you just brought up. And I'll hit each one of these points as we go along, but we'll start with the first one. Animal size, there's a lot of advantages to something being large in the wilderness, especially in this region of the country. In cold weather, large animals lose body heat slower than small animals.
Yeah.
And this makes them more adaptable to where temperatures fluctuate, which, you know, we get, especially in North America, because we typically get four seasons of the year where temperatures range pretty wildly. I guess I can just go down the list and you guys can comment if you want to on this. So large animals lose body heat slower than small animals. It's because they have a slower metabolic rate than small animals do. When it comes to food, large animals need larger amounts of food. However, because of the lower metabolic rate, pound for pound, they require less food than smaller animals do.
Right, right.
The paper went on to talk about things like evolving into larger forms, or animals evolve into larger forms because it makes them better at reproducing, which is what makes a species successful. You know, if you're able to reproduce, then you're basically a successful species. It allows them to live longer, they're better at acquiring food, they're bigger and faster, they're better at hiding from predators, us in this case, and it's all geared towards being better at reproducing. So, and the larger size, let me see here, there is, oh, now here's, oh, so go ahead and give me your thoughts on what I just mentioned there.
Well, for one, for people to, what you were saying, people wondering why something so large, why they would need to be so large. Well, to me, my thought would be to survive in such an environment, like you said, well, they're going to need to be larger.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Right. Well, and there's another reason, too, when you look at especially food gathering. Especially, again, we go back to the type of forest where they typically live in. You know, they're not just going to go up and grab pine needles and start eating them. I don't know if you guys ever seen the old commercials from the 70s. There was a guy, and I can't remember what his background was. His name was Yul Gibbons, and he used to run a commercial.
Oh, yeah.
And it was for grape nut cereal. And the guy would say, he'd come on there, and here's this old guy, and he said, "You ever eat a pine tree? Many parts of it are edible." You know, of course, then the guy died of an ulcer later, so.
Yeah.
Don't. The moral of the story is don't eat pine
trees. You're right.
So I'm sure the Sasquatch already knew that. So, but for an animal to get enough intake, its food intake, you know, especially in an environment where maybe it's harder to get food, it comes by its food, you know, fewer and far between. It's easier if it's bigger to cover more territory to get the same amount of food that it requires. Right. So,
absolutely.
You know, elephants and things like that are a pretty good example.
Well, you know, and something else I was just thinking about, and back to the northern, okay, creatures, any animal, you know, the theory that the further north we are, the larger they are, okay. Let's take prey animals. Let's take the white-tailed deer, for instance. You know, I know up where I am and where Don is, they're much, much larger than, say, down.
Pennsylvania, right.
Down the, or even, you know, in the southern U.S. Yeah. Okay. Now,
right.
That's going to, in turn, I mean, you know, a Sasquatch is going to take down whatever. But in turn, or an evolution standpoint, that's going to take a larger predator to take down a larger animal of prey. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And typically, too, it talks about, and I can, this is something, well, no, go ahead. I was going to read some more stuff from what I wrote, but it doesn't really fit in just yet in this part of the conversation.
No, that's okay. You know, and that's...
But it also fits a lot of the sightings, you know, the stories we hear from people, you know, especially in terms of hunting or food gathering or the kinds of things they do.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's going to... And like we hear... That's why we hear the stories... We regularly hear the stories of these creatures down south being a little bit smaller.
We just had, I was telling you guys before we came on that Jay, our Southeastern Regional Director, just went on an investigation in Alabama. And actually, there were two, what we think are two types there, because, and this is interesting, because there was the one type, and the people there saw a couple of these things, have been seeing them over time. It's like what you just talked about in the beginning, giving us the news. You know, where they have a long, kind of a long-term area of activity. So they've seen a couple of these really big ones that look more like what you see in a Patterson film. Then they see a couple other ones, and this is interesting, the smaller ones that are more man size are always together, either two or three of them together. They're never usually alone, where the big ones they see solitarily occasionally. But the people there pointed out, they went online when Jay was there and they looked at these pictures of apes, and they picked out a particular one and they said it looks exactly like that, where the facially they were completely different than the bigger types. So here's something to throw into the conversation. And I was hoping KD would be with us. Being a scientist, he'd probably be familiar with this. There's something called Cope's Rule.
Yeah.
Cope's Rule says evolution tends to increase body size over geologic time in a lineage of populations. And what they were suggesting with that particular theory is that most species over time go from smaller to larger. I mean, everybody always, you hear people commonly say today that humans are much bigger today than they were 100 years ago or 200 years ago. And that's true. I mean, average height is much larger than we were, you know, 100, 200, 300 years ago. So it goes to show, or it's possible that Sasquatch is the same. So here's a thought, too. Larger size, evolutionary, could suggest that they are an older species than humans. And this is sort of supported by the fact that a lot of native peoples throughout the world say that these creatures inhabited the areas that their people first came to. They were already there when they came, when humans came.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
And basically, you know, anthropologists are saying that primate species came out of Africa in waves. They didn't all just go out together. As species evolved, they would go out in successive waves. And these creatures could have been from one of the much earlier waves. Humans were sort of among the last primate species that came out of Africa. So we're sort of latecomers to the game. So large body size does a couple of things when in terms of these things. It works for them in terms of survival and, you know, reproducing. And with a much larger body size, it could demonstrate that they're a much older species than we are.
Right.
So it actually, scientifically, it sort of fits, you know, I mean, it would make sense, you know, if people are saying, well, if something like this exists, you know, why is it so big? Why is it this? Or why is it that? When it actually fits the actual, you know, what we would expect to see.
Yeah.
How tall did they estimate that Gigantopithecus was of the tooth they found there out in Asia?
Actually, the Chinese, last I read, the Chinese were saying roughly 12 feet high.
Okay.
That's huge.
Yeah.
Around 1,500 pounds. So, yeah, that was, I mean, and again, that's an example. I mean, that's something we absolutely do know exists because we have the fossil remains. Right. And, you know, for people to say, oh, something like that couldn't exist, that's nonsense, because the Sasquatch isn't that big. So we have a known species that did exist that was bigger.
Right.
You know, and as far as, it's a little bit off the topic, but that's what we do.
That's what we do.
And I think I mentioned this to you, Will. As far as the weight, you know, you and I have discussed the weight of these big males several times. You know, and a lot of people will say, oh, they're 600, 700, 800 pounds. Well, I personally think they tip the scales a hell of a lot heavier than that. Now, if you go back and you do some research on that, you know, that guy Robert Wadlow, okay, who was he was the tallest man that ever lived. He was at his highest, as tall as he was 8 foot 11, pushing the scales at 550 pounds. Okay. Now, if you look
sure on a human yes, frame,
if you look at a Sasquatch, a full, you know, a mature male Sasquatch that's 8'11", it's going to be a hell of a lot larger than 550 pounds. Well, so
muscle.
Oh, at least
it's at least double, double yeah. that. So I, you know, I'm more, I'm going to say more towards, you know, 12, 13, 1400 pounds, you know? So I think we tend to, underestimate the weight of these things sometimes.
Yeah. I think a lot of people, and it's funny, you know, it cracks me up that to this day, after all these years, people are still trying to analyze the Patterson film. And that's one of the things they're always trying to guesstimate is weight. And, you know, Patterson and Gimlin, in that particular situation, that day, Patterson, you know, they were both wearing cowboy boots with the large heels and stuff, Patterson jumped off a stump near where the tracks were, barely made an impression in the ground. Of course, Patterson was a little guy, but they also walked one of the horses that I think was around 1,200 pounds also along the tracks. And weren't anywhere near the depth right. the tracks of the Sasquatch were. So, you know, it had to be, and people were saying, oh, it's 300 or 400 pounds. Well, it had to be a hell of a lot heavier than 300 or 400 pounds.
Right.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah, but just the muscle mass. Muscle weighs so much more than fat, you know.
It does, absolutely. I mean,
you can, I mean, what was his, when they... When they asked him what he thought she weighed, what was his first initial response? But
I don't recall. I do remember them saying that they thought it was, you know, 300-400 pounds, something in that range.
And then, I mean,
but then again, I mean, but you got guys who are pretty excited and everything. So I mean, I don't know what their thought process
right,
was.
At right, right. You know, and these, you know, and as far as these males go, you know, within these species, they're built totally different than these females, and they are. I mean, in my opinion, they're considerably larger. I don't know if you agree, Will or Don, you know, Chance, but you know, from my experience,
well, it's very likely because. If you look at gorillas, for instance, you know, some of the big males are much larger, especially the silverbacks, and the dominant ones are much larger than the females and the submales in the groups.
Or, I mean, not even so much as larger, but just different, you know? I mean, even human men.
Well, yeah, and when it comes with humans, it's a little bit different because we're used to looking at each other and noticing all the nuances and differences. Yeah. So I was going to say, you know, with a lot of with primate species, you could probably tell. This is one of the things I gathered from my anthropology classes a long time ago, where the professor talked one day about the males. And even in human populations, typically in the upper bodies where the center of gravity is, And we're built larger in the upper body, where in females, the center of gravity is lower, more towards the hips, and that's where they've got more size there. And I guess I'm trying to tread ground lightly here because I don't want to try to say that women have big butts, you know, but in with females, it's because of the wider hips for birthing and stuff.
Right.
But generally, you should be able to tell from the back, you know, one of these things. And you look at the Patterson film, you know, having seen a Sasquatch, actually three of them, you know, that were much larger in the shoulder areas and chest and narrower and I'm not talking skinny or narrow, but as you go down the body, they were like a tree trunk. But there wasn't any real, you know, change in width as you got down to the hips, where you look at the Patterson film and it's not really so wide through the shoulders, but it does have a very, very sturdy, you know, hip area and that part of the body. It looks female from the
yes,
back.
Definitely. The way, you know, like you said, the sloping shoulders. Right. She's a beast, that's for sure. But you know,
yeah, you don't want to go trying to give yeah, that one a no, hard time, no. But but still, the males know, the males do look different.
Just a very an impressive creature. You know, it's something. You know, while we're on this talking about how they adapted their environment, I will give one thing away that one of the guys was telling me yesterday. It was fall time, and it had just turned orange, you know, and they were up near another one of our spots, and he was looking, they were on top of a bridge, and he was looking down into the bridge by the brook, and he noticed something wasn't right. Something was off, and he just couldn't put his finger on it. So he looked again, and he said, "No, just something's not right." So, you know, he finally got the outline of this thing, and this thing, it was squatting down, and it was mixed in with the orange foliage, perfectly camouflaged, squatting down, not squatting down on its butt, but kind of like in a football player stance, you know, with the color of its fur, with the orange leaves, so they know how to blend in, and they know when to blend in, which is interesting. You know, they know what time of year do I blend in with my color of hair, you know? Do you know what I mean?
Whether to act like a tree or to act like a rock or a stump, their intelligence to be stealthy is incredible. See,
absolutely. I mean...
That's another thing, and it's...
Oh. We have Chance.
Speak away, brother.
No, I'm just kind of taking it all in. I was gonna bring up and, you know, and mention the fact that, you know, if you look at any, you know, major, you know, predator like a Sasquatch, look at, you know, wolves, for example. You know, wolves have an amazing ability, you know, to adapt into their environment. You know, you have, you know, anything from, you know, their smell to their sense of hearing to, you know, to the color of their fur. You know, I mean, it's all amazing, you know.
Wolves are just awesome.
And I mean, that's, you know, that's an animal that's obviously, you know, that's been around and discovered how long ago, you know? So, I mean, you look at, you know, something, you know, even on a larger scale and it's more massive, you know, like a Sasquatch that we don't have, you know, that does not have definitive proof. You know, you can only imagine how well they've been able to adapt to everything to go, you know, that unnoticed and uncovered for so long.
Right.
It's kind of my...
And I'll tell you something. What they they're very likely a leftover from, you know, during the Ice Age 10,000 plus years ago, when we had a lot of what they term as megafauna, in the world, and these guys would have fit right into that because of their large size and predatory behaviors and everything, and I think they probably survived that. Well, obviously they did. They're still here where a lot of the megafauna died out. So they were obviously very successful during that time. So a lot of people today, I think, have a mistaken idea that, you know, Sasquatches get cold. They couldn't survive in these kind of environments. I think they thrive in those kind of environments. And again, when I find tracks a lot of times over the years, especially near snow lines, it's never coming down out of the snow. It's always going up into the snow lines.
Right. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, that makes perfect sense, you know, when you think about it.
Right.
Yeah, I think they do very well in those cold.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they wouldn't be here otherwise. They'd move down south, you know.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Absolutely.
Don. Absolutely. You're right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, just... and this is the time of year that the sightings start around here, because it's the only way to really see them is in the snow.
Right. So,
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So what other kind of attributes? And we talk about size,
strength, you know,
speed.
Well, their ability to use weapons. You know, I know other animal can really do that. A lot of primate, in North America.
Well, especially in terms of throwing rocks and things.
Very proficient. I mean, what intimidates me, you know, I'm enthralled with these creatures and this whole thing, this whole group, and, you know, it's my passion and my obsession. I love it. It's my world. But what intimidates me is knowing that when I am out there, even when I'm with my partners and I'm out there, that if one of these things wants to reach out and grab me, whether I have a firearm or not, yeah, it's going to do it. And that's all. And that's
paper.
All there is to it. And there's not a thing you're going to do about it. And it's true. They're a master of their environment. And I'm not trying to say they're trying to kill off the human species. But I'm just saying, you know what I mean. We're talking about strength and stealthiness and whatnot. And that's what they're just good at what they do. They've survived this long.
Well, right, and that's all kind of geared around predatory behavior. And it's one thing a lot of people out there that are interested in the subject really haven't wrapped their heads around. You know, they ask all these questions. But, and again, if you look at predatory behavior, sort of the foundation for looking at them in the proper perspective, because if you look at what other predatory animals do in North America, for instance, why haven't we got a body? Well, we've mentioned this numerous times. Go find the body of a bear.
Exactly.
Find the body of a
cougar. You're not going
to. It's extremely rare. So if you've got a species populating an area, and again, a range for a Sasquatch is a minimum for a group of them, 4 to 6 individuals, a minimum of 500 square miles. Minimum 500 square miles. Heck, when I was looking at the Mount St. Helens South area, you know, we had, there are two groups that occupy 3,300 square miles in that area. Good luck finding them if you want to go out and just track them. A dead body, good luck with that.
You know, and it's like last night, you know, we were having Chance and myself, Shane, we were having a group conversation on Messenger. And I was explaining to Dustin about the Adirondack Park, how my theory, and I know from years of research, we're talking about this. I believe the whole Whitehall group that people talk about, they've moved northernward. The groups that were in the central Adirondacks have moved up towards my way. Now, he asked me a question. So you're saying they're all concentrated in these areas now? And he said, well, Will said they travel all these 500 mile radiuses. And I said, absolutely right, they do. And I said, Dustin, you got to understand. I said, the Adirondack Park is 6.2 million acres. If you want to go out there and try to track these things down and follow them around these these huge national parks, have at it. You know,
if they have everything they need in one area, they would stay there, though, right?
Well, for a time. Now, if you look at large groups of gorillas, okay, and you use comparative anthropology to see, you know, to figure out what these guys are doing, look and see what other primates do. And there's a reason. I mean, if you have everything in your area, that's fine, but there's one element that you're not considering, and that's predators.
Right.
One reason you would keep moving is to throw predators off.
Right. Okay.
And with these things, now sometimes they will stay in an area for an extended time period, but eventually they're going to move. They're not going to stay in one area, you know, for years and years on end. And I know there are some people, a few, not a lot, that have made that claim, but I would be willing to bet in those circumstances they've got more than one group, and what's happening is one group is going, one is coming. So if they see them over an extended time period, they're probably not seeing the same
thing. That's what I'm thinking is going on at this new place we picked up out here.
Because
and I think it's two groups. One's moving in, one's moving out.
Right. I mean,
sure, they're going
to. Right, especially if it's two different types, in my opinion.
Yeah, very true.
Opinion.
Very true.
Okay. Now, what if the other territories around them are taken by other groups? Will they still go through those areas?
Yeah, their territories overlap.
Sorry, Chance.
Oh no, you're fine. I was just gonna bring up the point. You know, I think I've brought it up. You know, on our group page. I know Jeremiah and Will. I've had this conversation with you and one of my team leads here, Nick. You know, I mean, you think about, again, you know, to go back, you know, to bring up the wolf issue. But, I mean, you think wolves have something crazy like a territorial range, you know, of 500 miles.
Yeah, it's huge.
They have a territorial range of 500 miles. They have, you know, like something like a kill range of like 300 miles. And then they don't usually, outside of that, they don't venture, you know, too far out of, you know, their den range of like 100 miles. And that's, you know, that's wolves, you know. And
they don't need to, really, because the thing with let's take our wild cat. Let's take our apex predators as far as cats, okay, lions, tigers, leopards. Now, they've got about a 75% kill ratio. When they'll kill about 75% of what they go after. Now, when we take wolves, painted dogs in Africa, dingoes, they'll take down about 95% of what they go after. They don't need to move out of those areas.
Exactly. I mean, and then you think, I know Will's brought it up before, but I mean, you think of, you know, something as massive, you know, as a Sasquatch that's going to keep, you know, that's going to spend the majority of its waking hours, you know, hunting, trying to get that food source, you know, just to maintain and sustain, you know, life. It makes perfect sense that they would constantly, you know, be on the move and migrating from one area to another. And
right,
mm-hmm. You know,
sure. And there's a couple of reasons. Number one, you don't want to deplete your food source in a particular area. Right. And secondly, if a predator stays in there, especially an apex predator, it's going to scare the hell out of everything that's there. If they're there too long, pretty soon the animals are going to bug out. And I've seen that in my area number four that I have up here north of me. When the Sasquatches are in there, again, you know, I know they're there because they crap everywhere. They're kind of nasty creatures when it comes to that. But it isn't long, about a month after they're there, you see absolutely no deer sign. The deer have bugged out of the area. Right. So if they're there too long, the game's going to go.
Yeah, I noticed when they moved into my area, all the game from up on the hill came embedded down right next to my house.
You hear me? I had me too.
I had grouse down here. I had and deer. We're less than 100 feet bedding from my house.
Yep.
Hiding in my scent.
And I think that's because maybe they know that humans are, you know, a predatory creature to these things.
You think that?
You know, they're in most cases are very wary. Yeah.
Now I've had about 10 years ago. I had a group of deer, about six does, run directly at me while I was mushrooming. And one of them stopped right next to me, about 10 feet from me, and just stopped and stared at me, and then just slowly walked away. But they all came right at me. And I always wondered.
That's not
No, and I always wondered, looking back, if that's what was happening. They were being chased or spooked.
Yeah, it could very well be.
That's something that I always, you know, bring up to people that are newer to the field, you know, as well. That's... You know, I think that's why it's always really important to know, you know, the wildlife that's in your area and why it's important, you know, to pay attention, not only to know the wildlife in your area, but to pay attention to what they're doing, you know, because just that alone can give you some huge clues in the field, you know, and some insight as to what's going on if you just, you know, take the time to learn the wildlife in your area and, you know, watch what they're doing.
Yeah. Absolutely true. I've noticed around here in the wintertime, they all share the same major game trails. which makes it a little easier to locate these, the big guys, the Squatch, because they'll be looking at the game trails. In fact, one of those game trails was a point of escape for a Squatch sighting here about 6-7 years ago. They tracked it right to a game trail that was packed down frozen, and that's where they lost the track. So, but yeah, I noticed absolutely. I have one behind my house, and I've seen all the animals on that game trail. A deer, the coyotes, the fox. There's a bear that uses it. But in the wintertime, you've got 5 feet of snow. They have to use a trail like that to get through these areas.
See, and the Sasquatch is
all the game, right? Yep. So, I mean, I think that's why they were here, and that's why they've been here, because of that game trail. Because there's always a lot of deer that travel that game trail.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. How about, and there's another thing, too, we talk about, and this is one of the areas that was sort of in contention for a long time, you know, them being nocturnal versus daytime. The correct term, I think, is diurnal, which means they can operate equally at night or in daytime. But, you know, hunting, especially deer and things like that, you know, most predators will hunt at night.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, so again, it really fits the mold. If you've got a real creature out there, you have to ask yourself, okay, if you had something real, what would fit the pattern of it being legitimate? And, you know, hunting at night is absolutely a legitimate thing, especially when we look at where they're hunting. It's very important. In the date, and they're going to be, again, they're going to be where the game animals can't smell them, typically, because deer, animals with long snouts, that's one of their biggest defenses, of being able to smell predators. And hearing them, of course, hearing them isn't so much important, because these guys are really stealthy, and they're going to ambush their prey. So, if you can smell a prey, you want to be upwind of it, or a predator, I mean. You smell a predator, the predator has to be upwind of the game animal. So in the daytime, typically, because when the air is heated, the daytime it rises, so you want to be above the game animals. At nighttime, you want to be below them, because air is cooling, it goes down. And that's typically where we see these
creatures. Yes, that's what happened here this summer. Exactly. You know, they came down low every night, and where they bed down is at the top of the hill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the daytime.
Hmm.
So what do you guys think? Any other attributes that would be
speed?
Mentioning?
Speed. I was going to ask you about their eyes. I've heard reports some have whites in their eyes, but I mean, the one I saw was totally black eyes. Does that is that by, like, do Squatches down in the south tend to have the whites in their eyes? And the ones up in the northern who have less light have the blacker eyes?
It'd be better if we had, you know, of course, our anthropologist on here to answer that. But I think, you know, when it comes to primates, when you look at other primates, I mean, yeah, you do see, like, I think gorillas, a lot of times it looks like they have completely dark eyes. But I think there actually is some white in there. I don't really have a good answer for that question. That's something an anthropologist have to answer. But I think they're going to have some white in there. I don't think it's completely dark. I mean, there's no animal, you know, no primate that has an eye that's completely.
Okay.
Now I have a good point. good question, and it's kind of going to sound humorous, but I assure you it's not. And you know me, I come up with some good ones. Now,
it's a good thing TW is not here, then.
That's the only reason I bring it up. Let's take bonobos for example. Okay, bonobos are one of the only, primates, in fact, one of the only animals on the planet that have sex for pleasure other than human beings. Always wondered about the Sasquatch.
Something nobody really knows about, to be
right.
Honest.
I mean, unless we got out
there. It's not something that's really observed. Unless you're.
We got out there with a midget with a camera and we did a film. But, you know, but it's out of curiosity's sake, you know, it makes you wonder.
Yeah, it's hard enough just getting a picture of one, let alone, you know, a porno or something like that. TW would say we'd have to have a Shaganova film or something, you know.
Wasn't there Wasn't there a guy in California that witnessed three of them, two females and a male, having sex, and he, like, shot at them or something?
Oh, you're thinking it.
It could be. I think it
was out west somewhere. He said he witnessed them having sex in the missionary position, and there was a female sitting right next to him, either waiting her turn or already had her turn. But he shot at him.
Is that one of those?
I don't know. it was on an encounter site. It was a couple years ago that I heard it.
I know.
I didn't know if anyone else had heard that one.
I don't know if I want to drop the name, but I know who you're thinking of, and I don't know if that's what he said or what. But was he bear hunting?
Well, you know.
Yeah, he was out hunting, right?
Yeah,
he was sitting somewhere, and he was walking and came upon them.
It was Smea there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I know that guy. I don't believe
me neither.
Says,
me neither.
So. Okay.
I don't know. Maybe it was wishful thinking on his part. Maybe he thought he was going to get
his
turn,
thinking.
Too. I don't know.
Thought he was going to join in, pulled a gunpoint, threatened him. I don't know. Who knows?
You know, anytime, it's been my experience over all these years that, and actually... And we're not quite there yet. I'm just a few days, about a week away from my 44th year of involvement in the subject. So I've heard some pretty good whoppers the years. And typically, if the story is too detailed or too outlandish, it's probably false.
Right.
So for anybody listening that wants to listen to somebody like that, you better listen really carefully. And there's so many stories. There's thousands of witness stories out there. And when you look at the bulk of them, they don't differ greatly in detail from one to the next. They're very similar, and there's a reason for that. It's because if you have a living creature out there that's going to any single bear stories, they're all very similar to one another and things like that. So they should be similar. The ones that are outlandish are probably fake.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because you know these sightings only last a split second, so...
Yeah, it's not like you're gonna hear the porno music and stand there and watch the things doing their business.
You're right. I mean?
See, Jeremiah got a visual.
That's great.
But, you know, I mean, that's one of those things nobody really knows about. So, speaking of TW, boy. I got to tell him. Okay. Well, what do you guys think? I mean, there are other physical attributes
physical. Geez, vocals. I noticed they're not... ones around here are not as vocal as they are in other areas. You don't get the screams around here. And they do everything they can around here not to be seen. And if they howled or screamed around here, they would be known. Somebody would hear them. So I think that's why they don't do it. I don't know. You know, because I have many recordings out while they were up there, and I don't have any howls. No howling, no screaming. Nobody's ever heard, I've never heard of an encounter or a sighting up here with a howl.
You know, that's interesting. We get different kinds of vocals, and nobody really knows the purpose of the vocals. I mean, I think a lot of times there must be... you know, communications between individuals about whatever it is their particular activities are at the moment, or even, you know, run-ins with other groups, things like that. I mean, we can guess at some of those, but nobody really knows what the vocals are used for. But we get a wide range of vocals, and they're very different.
And most of those vocals are recorded in way out in the woods, way out away from the public or the people.
Now, sometimes they will scream, you know, near people. And I know I had one of them that really sticks out in my mind. I've heard them in a number of places, but like you say, a lot of times they're in pretty remote areas. But we did hear a really, really loud one. Yeah, and I didn't get
a chance. Was it provoked by you, or was it provoked by anything?
No, actually, there's a small campground. Well, it's up near on the Quinault River, actually, where it forks. It's about, I don't know, 12, 13 miles upstream from the Highway 101, where you go up the road, and the road forks. And on one side, there's a campground. The other side, there was a tiny campground with some kind of rough campsites with seven of them there. And we decided to camp on that side one year. This was probably, I think, a dozen years ago. But my girlfriend at the time, we decided to take a walk up the road after we got done eating. And I had my recorder in my pocket, and there's this really big ridge that divides, I mean, this mountain that divides the two roads and the river there. And probably 100 feet or 200 feet above where we were was where this thing was, and it screamed super loud. It only did it one time, but you could hear people everywhere, you know, saying, "Oh my God, what was that?" Dogs barking and everything, but it only did it one time, but it wasn't close enough for anybody to be provoked. So why it did it, I couldn't tell you, unless, I mean, it was trying to alert the others in the group that there were a bunch of people up there. I mean,
because
I don't know.
The screams that I had one scream here myself. I stepped out of my house with my dog and I got screamed at. Another scream, a guy was burning brush in the woods, and he got screamed at, him and another fireman. They got screamed at from the other side of the fire. And
yeah, I've heard stories like that too. I can relate one to you. There was a guy who, back in 1992, I interviewed him about, let me back up a little bit. It's when we did our Bigfoot barbecue and potluck south of Mount St. Helens. And on the second day of the event, we had set up where, you know, the PCSIT members were sort of set up strategically around the campground in little clusters with the people who attended. And basically what we were doing was collecting accounts from people. And one of my people came over and said there was a guy who had been watching us, and he liked what I was saying, so he wanted to tell me his story. And this guy was huge. The guy was like, you know, 6'5", 6'6", 300 pounds. And he said that he was an ex-Hell's Angel. And I have no doubt, no trouble believing him on that by the looks of him. But he turned out to be a really nice guy. And back in the 60s, he had an account in Southern Oregon where him and another one of his buddies who belonged to the group there were going to go look for a meteor. And they got into an area and set up camp. And this thing came down this ridge screaming. And it actually got to the edge of their firelight and was grabbing a couple of saplings and thrashing them violently and screaming at them. And they said, "We thought we were on the menu." And they both shot it in the chest with their 30-30s, and it took off screeching as it ran.
Wow.
You know, so to me, that was an obvious challenge.
Okay.
They actually thought it was a guy, you know, some guy up on the ridge, and they were gonna give the guy some crap, I guess, if he came down and give him any trouble. So when they saw this thing, they just said it was a monster. You know, that's all they described it as.
Jeez.
You know, pretty scary situation, actually.
Yes. Yeah. You don't realize how small you are.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
So a lot, you know, we talk vocals. A lot of these situations, I mean, it really depends on the circumstances. I mean, you can, like in that case, you can tell, I think, pretty clearly what the screaming was about. In others, it's really hard to tell.
Yeah, and I got a wide range of vocals here, and I noticed they were everything that I was doing. I don't know if they mimicked everything I did. Locate a call, mouth pops, whistles. I got everything back that I did to them. I came out and...
That could be very
just
well.
Mimicking me, just mimicking. Yeah. Because I came out and burped one night, and I got a mouth pop, and I got that recorded. So I don't know what that was written response to. I don't know.
It's a good thing.
Yeah, right.
Anything else.
Yeah, He would have been close enough to hear that.
I wasn't going to elaborate there.
But I'll share that one soon.
We talk. You know, people always talk about a noxious odor. You might have got a really noxious odor back. That's the kind of mimicry you don't want.
Yeah, I know. It's funny, though, just the variety of sounds that they were giving me. You know, and then when they wanted to be seen, they just would be seen or heard. They would just crash through and just walk through the woods. And they never walked away from us. They always walked from, like, the 2 o'clock position to the 10 o'clock. When they wanted...
So they were walking across your...
Yeah, that's the night of the bone. And he wanted to be seen or heard that night. And maybe it was, I thought about it afterwards, maybe it was to divert attention. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. While another one was doing something else.
Right, right. Yeah.
Yeah, because if they show themselves, there's a reason for it. You got to question what else is going on around the area. Because they almost always...
No, there was two of them that night. I can hear two of them, and then you get those vocals. It sounds like two different ones. It's
right.
Very interesting. I really want to... I'll download that file, that audio file. I just... It's so long, I want to cut it up a little bit.
Yeah, and I mentioned that when... you know, I'll record with you again, Don. We had tried to do it before, and the audio didn't come out very well. But we'll re-record, and we'll put some of that audio in there so that our listeners can hear that. And I know we've got some really good audio from different locations around the country. We'll incorporate those into different shows.
Yeah, Jeremiah has some good ones too.
Yeah, absolutely. And so does Jay and some of the other teams around the country.
Oh, good.
No, we're doing.
So as we,
I think we're doing pretty well.
Yeah, it's been a pretty active year, getting a lot of activity.
Before we wrap up, Mark. Guys, do you want to? Is there any final thoughts? Any final thoughts, or do you guys want to plug your individual regions?
I got a lot of good stuff going on up here. In this
Okay, Jeremiah, go ahead and give out your email or any other information, contact information you want to, if you want people to contact you in your region. Jeremiah heads the northeastern region of the United States and eastern Canada.
Just feel free. We're still looking for team leaders, team members. Feel free to get a hold of me. We're desperately looking. We're always looking for people. My email is jrg.dirjf@gmail.com. My phone number is 518-319-2659, and my two assistants will give you their contact info right now.
Oh, go ahead, Chance.
I can be reached by email at jrg.assst.regbir.ch@gmail.com. Also accessible on Facebook or through the JRG Facebook group. Just search Chance Honeycutt. Those are usually the two best ways to get a hold of me.
Don, how about you?
Okay. They got a hold of me is jrgdowneastmaine@gmail.com. Or you could call my phone number at 207-323-0419.
Yeah, and if anybody has, you know, if you don't remember that, that's okay. You can go on my website, williamjevning.com. As you scroll down the main page, you're going to see some things at the top. One of those is research groups. Just place your cursor over research groups, and you'll get a drop-down menu for the pages. And you can go on to, any one of those pages and get a hold of people. Typically, we get regional directors. And I think, Jeremiah, I think Don's. Don, you have a page, but I think Chance's email is in
your page. Yeah, I believe so. We're getting that taken care of. But
if you even if you get a hold of Jeremiah, you know he can get you in touch with any of the guys. So, but again, you know, go to my website williamjevning.com, and also the Facebook page. It's the JRG Bigfoot Research Group. And you can get a hold of anybody there, so that's pretty common.
We're all on the same team, so.
Yep.
All right, fellows. Well, great job. Great discussion. We'll do
it. All right, gentlemen. Thank you. Well.
All right, everyone. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you enjoyed our chat.